A little more than a century ago, explorer Roald Amundsen, along with members of his team, planted the Norwegian flag at the South Pole, the first humans to make it to one of the most inhospitable places in the world. No one died on that expedition, which was not the case with Robert Falcon Scott and his team. They arrived at the South Pole a month later. Five of them, including Scott, died from starvation and exposure on their way home. Our guest Ross McPhee tells this heroic and tragic story in his book, Race to the End of the Earth, Amundsen, Scott, and the Attainment of the South Pole. Included are original photographs of the time showing just how harsh the conditions were and just how dangerous the expeditions were. Ross McPhee is a curator in the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History, also an expert on ancient mammals and their extinction. In fact, he's traveled five times to Antarctica. The last time was a year ago. And Ross McPhee, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
What's the allure of the South Pole, or what was the allure of the South Pole 100 years ago?
Well, it's a little hard to explain to people today because with satellite imagery and so forth, there's no part of at least the terrestrial side of the Earth that we don't know practically everything there is to know.
Right.
But 100 years ago, there was no place more mysterious than the poles. The North Pole had been reached probably or possibly in 1909. It's controversial. That left the South Pole as literally the last place on Earth that humans had not attained. Another thing to bear in mind is that at this time, the great powers like Britain were terrifically concerned about owning just about every
the
part
world,
of the
right?
globe that they could. And it had its sort of farcical aspect in a way, because when you think about it, 100 years ago, it would be hard to put your finger on what Antarctica might be good for. But nevertheless, there was interest, not only on the part of Britain, but Germany, Japan, other nations, including the U.S. eventually, all had their teams going to the Antarctic, in some cases to claim land, in other cases simply to explore, and in particular, and we'll talk about this later, to do science.
Indeed. Well, let's talk a bit about these two men, beginning with Robert Falcon Scott. He was a naval officer. How did he get, in a sense, tapped to lead this expedition to the South Pole? Why him?
Scott is a study in all kinds of contrasts. And to understand him, you have to understand, I think, his most basic of motivations. He was not an explorer by nature. He joined as a cadet the British Navy when he was 13, which was typical of the time, and was a Navy officer for the entire rest of his career. He was a technical person. He was interested in machinery. He was an expert in electricity,
yeah,
which was one of the novel things.
And you
use
quotation marks on the radio, yes, and right. Torpedoes apparently as well.
He was a torpedo specialist. So what's a man like that doing running an expedition to Antarctica? Well, this is how it happened. In the very last years of the 19th century, he was a lieutenant in the British Navy. He was regarded as competent and eventually would have probably at least made captain grade. But Britain wasn't fighting any Navy wars, at least at the time, and there were a lot of people on the Navy list or the promotion list that were ahead of him. And he had a big problem, which was that his father had just died. He had bankrupted the family, and Scott was now responsible for his widowed mother and unmarried sisters. And on a lieutenant's pay, he didn't see how he was going to make ends meet. So he had heard that the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Society, two different societies in Britain, were coming together to start or to push for the first Antarctic expedition out of Britain, at least officially, for at least 50 or 60 years. And it was a big deal. Nevertheless, what Scott thought was, I have a certain number of qualifications, and I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, which he did.
And what for made, the money, do you think?
I mean, well, it had to money? Be. It had to be partly for the money. There is no doubt it also meant more rapid advancement. This was another thing that was true of the Royal Navy in the 19th and early 20th centuries, that if you did Arctic service, as it then was, or polar service later on, you kind of got a leg up and you got fast-tracked. So what he saw was that not only would there be money, but there would be advancement in rank.
Does that tell us he was an ambitious man?
He was certainly an ambitious man, but a man who was who suffered from very bad, I think, attacks of indecision about what he was meant to do in his life. He as I said, was very technologically oriented. If he were alive today, I have no doubt he would have been a scientist, perhaps even a leading scientist. He had that kind of a mind. He was very concerned about his relatives, and eventually he married just before leaving on his second expedition, which is the one we'll be talking about mostly, and terribly concerned when he knew he was dying, along with his companions on the Ross Ice Shelf, that in the very last entry in his journal, he said, "For God's sake, look after our people." Now, you can say what you like about Scott as being a bumbler and incompetent and all the rest of it, but here's a man who at the end was thinking not only of his own reputation and whether or not it would survive, but what to do about the people left behind. And for that, I've often felt a real affection for Scott as somebody who did his best. And yes, the best was not good enough in the end, but he did what he could.
Well, and I do want to talk about each of these expeditions, but let me also ask you about Roald Amundsen, a very different kind of expedition leader and an actual explorer.
Roald Amundsen was the, if I may, the polar opposite of Scott.
You can do that once during the hour, and that's it.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay, I've been warned. He, from the age of about 15, as he relates in his biography, from the age of 15, there was only one thing he wanted to do. He wanted to be an explorer, and because he was Norwegian, he wanted to be an Arctic explorer. His mother didn't think much of that. Mum wanted him to be a doctor, and he dutifully went to medical school until she died, and then he dropped it like a hot tamale and went off to sea to gain experience, because the way you got around, certainly at that time, was by sea, whether you were going to explore Africa or the Arctic. It didn't matter. He went first to the Antarctic in 1899 on a Belgian expedition, so he was there before Scott was. Scott was not there first until 1901. He was not the leader. He went as a mate, and this was a hideously poorly run expedition. People died, scurvy broke out. It was not good. But Amundsen being Amundsen, he could focus like nearly no one I know of. He could focus on what he wanted to accomplish, and it set him in motion for the rest of his career. He saw that this is not only something I can do, but this is what I want to do. He came back to Norway and managed to organize an expedition in 1906 called the Jule. I apologize to any Norwegian listeners. The Jule expedition made the first crossing of the Northwest Passage, which is something that the British Royal Navy had tried for many, many years, always unsuccessfully. And that brought him instant acclaim, because here he was, a man from a very small, not well-known Northern European country, and he and a few companions went out and did something that nobody thought they could do. Hmm. How it was very beneficial for him at the time was that he actually lived more than a year with the Netsilik Inuit and learned a lot about Arctic survival that you wouldn't learn just by reading books or even living in a place like Scandinavia. And that put him in very good stead for his later career in the Antarctic.
Let me ask you, and I have to say, and this doesn't work on the radio, but the photographs show us how difficult the conditions were. And today we're used to, you know, Gore-Tex and fleece and all the things that keep us warm and you know, tents that will keep you warm in really, really cold conditions. And it's just hard to imagine the kind of material and equipment that these explorers would have that would actually allow them to survive.
Yeah, when you look at the pictures, it often looks, particularly in Scott's case, that they just went into their closet and put on
a hat and some sweaters or something
and took it south with them. That's not completely true. One contrast between the two expeditions is that Amundsen's was much smaller, and he was able to outfit. He had the money to outfit his people in furs. Scott took along many more people, and his second expedition was run on a comparative shoestring, and he wasn't able to do that. What he did instead was go the Royal Navy way, in the sense of getting the kind of clothing that was used by the Navy in the Canadian Arctic in the 19th century. And that meant gabardine, closely woven cotton clothes, woolies, that kind of thing. That there's in the book some illustrations of from some very strange headgear.
Yes, I noticed that.
That was utilized for the purpose. They both used tents that had been worked out in terms of their appropriateness for polar regions in Arctic exploration. These are often called Scott tents, which is misleading. Scott was not the designer, and the proper term is pyramid tents. They're able to withstand terrific forces provided by wind, for example, or snowstorms, that kind of thing. And at least in the typical case, they're double tents, they're double lined, so they're warm.
They're warm. They're actually warm. Going back to this, in a sense, race to the South Pole, it's interesting to think of Britain at the time, as you said, ruled much of the world. Scandinavia, by contrast, you know, not a world power. Just how much was the world watching, and just how competitive was it between these two countries?
Nobody saw Norway as a player in Antarctica. They were Norwegians. If they're going to spend any time anywhere, you'd think it would be the Arctic.
Exactly.
And it came as an utter surprise to the world that Amundsen in 1910 went south. And let me say a few words about that so it's clear. After the Jura expedition, he got a government support and got donor money to take another Arctic expedition, which was to explore parts of the Arctic Ocean. And the intention was to go all the way from Norway around Cape Horn into the Bering Strait, which you had to do at that time. This is 1909, 1910, mm-hmm. because the Panama Canal wasn't actually open to commerce until 1914. And he was raring to go. He had publications out that he was going to make the North Pole. And he got a vessel that was purpose-designed by the very famous Norwegian explorer Fridtjof Nansen a few years earlier, called Fram, which we'll have reason to mention again.
Fram, yes.
He had really everything going for him. And then he opened the papers sometime in 1909 to find that not only one but two Americans were claiming to have already gotten to the pole. This was Robert Peary and Fred Cook. So here is the quandary that Roald Amundsen faced. He never really had a job in the conventional sense. He was an explorer, and what he relied on was doing something brilliant that nobody else had done, to be first. And that allowed a lecture tour. This allowed him to put together books and things of this, all of which contributed very largely to his being able to ride from one success to the other. And suddenly, he's confronted by disaster.
And that's Ross McPhee, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Race to the End of the Earth, and that's the title of his book about the race to the South Pole. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pathways PA supports WHYY. Pathways PA Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program provides free income tax assistance to those earning less than $50,000 a year. Information at pathwayspa.org or 800-209-2914.
I'm Marty Moscowain. This is the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. We remind you several times a year that if you listen to WHYY, take that next step and become a supporter. We have an ambitious goal, 8,000 pledges, and we can make that goal if you make that call at 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Think of what you get on programs like Radio Times, in-depth interviews about local, national, and international news, issues, and events that matter to you. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We believe that you're the kind of person who is curious about the world we live in. We also know it takes a lot of work to keep up on everything. So we do your homework for you. We track down guests, invite your phone calls to create a lively and informative conversation. You don't hear that on the radio every day. Make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks so much.
10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, now hosting their annual rug event with an Oriental Rug Seminar Friday, February 10th at 7 p.m. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just about a century ago, Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen and British naval officer Robert Falcon Scott and their team set out to be the first to reach the South Pole. Amundsen beat Scott by a month. Scott and members of his team froze to death on their way home. It's a story of tragedy and heroism, and it's told along with pretty amazing original photographs of the expedition in a book called Race to the End of the Earth. And that book is written by our guest, Ross McPhee. He also is curator in the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Going back to Scott and also to Amundsen, and clearly Amundsen was a skilled and experienced explorer. He knew how to explore. And he had dog sleds, he had skis. He had a lot less material to haul on this expedition. Scott had ponies, many more things that he brought along the expedition. And he also had this notion that it would be the men who would be hauling all this stuff, whereas in Amundsen's mind, it was the dogs that were going to haul all this stuff. And that's really pretty significant.
It's tremendously significant what Amundsen had to say about Scott's idea of man hauling.
And that's what it was called, right, man hauling.
A very substantial distance to the pole, and then on the return, was that it was an abomination. This was using men as beasts of burden. Why would you possibly do that? So here's the contrast. Yeah. Amundsen, growing up in Scandinavia, where animals like dogs and even ponies were used as transportation animals, you didn't develop warm feelings. What you bred, in the case of the dogs, were super strong, in some cases very, very violent and vicious animals, because that was a measure of strength. And you used them, and you used them up. In fact, it was his plan in taking slightly over 50 dogs for his journey to the pole. This is 900 miles there, roughly, yeah. And 900 back. Was that he would come back with a dozen or less. And you ask, well, what happened to all the rest of them? Some of them died, some of them ran away, and a lot of them were shot and converted into food, both for the men and the other dogs. So he took his larder with him. Scott hated this idea. He was an Englishman, and the idea of sled dogs, this was abhorrent to him. They weren't proper English dogs. They ate their feces, and they fought to the death with one another, and so on. And he was like his men, in this fantasy world of the late 19th, early 20th century Britain, where they took upon themselves in many of these expeditions to do things the hard way just to prove that they were Brit and that therefore they would succeed. They would somehow muddle through. And as astounding as it is in some of the men's journals, they're very happy to hear that the last of the ponies have been shot. This is just before they're at the Transantarctic Mountains to ascend onto the polar plateau to go yet another 400 miles to get to the South Pole. They're very pleased because now it's all up to them. They're going to get into the traces and move their 600 to 700 pound sledges through the snowdrifts all the way and back again, and feel very pleased with themselves over it.
And hauling it themselves. This is the man hauling that you're talking about. Is that why... Some, including Scott himself, but four members of his team, is that why they essentially both died of starvation and exposure or exhaustion?
Another thing that, at least for me, that is very hard to understand about Scott is that he had two expeditions. The first one was the Discovery Expedition in 1901-1904. The second, on which he died, was the Terra Nova from 1911 to 1913, although he died himself in 1912.
Right.
So you'd think anybody who'd been to Antarctica, especially in an expeditionary kind of way, would have learned a lot. And he didn't. He didn't learn the most important things. And one of the most important things is, and anybody can relate to this, so let me just address it this way. You know, if you get a Charlie horse in your leg, or you sprain your ankle, you get a meniscus tear, it really doesn't matter. It hurts real bad, and you rest up until you feel better. He had no choice. Once he was embarked, He had no way of resupplying his food except from depots laid earlier. He was on a race against death in any case because of the oncoming austral winter. They couldn't just kick back and relax if something happened. And what happened was entirely expected as they were manhauling on the journey home, one after another, frozen feet, frozen faces, shoulders at least partly dislocated, bad knee problems, and they went slower and slower and slower until, along with the fact they were out of food, nearly out of fuel, and the winter was coming down on them.
And they kept
could
going.
Go no further.
I mean,
well, they kept going until the last possible minute. They were still about 150 miles from relief at their base at Cape Evans on McMurdo Sound. And it's often said, well, if they'd only made that last depot, they were about 12 and a half miles, statute miles, from a very large depot that had been deposited in the year earlier. But these were men who were at the limit. They were in no way going to make that last 150 miles in any kind of efficient way. So I'm not saying really that Scott killed himself. I am saying that he didn't pay proper attention. And that's the contrast with Amundsen. I've got a quote here if I could
Yes, please, go ahead.
Very famous one by Amundsen. It's about expeditioneering. I may say that this is the greatest factor. The way in which the expedition is equipped, the way in which every difficulty is foreseen, and precautions taken for meeting or avoiding it. Victory awaits him who has everything in order. Luck, people call it. Defeat is certain for him who has neglected to take the necessary precautions in time. This is called bad luck. That tells you where Amundsen is coming from.
Yeah.
He was a massive overcompensator. He had depots up the wazoo. He had more dogs than he needed, and so on and so on and so on, which is why he came back, as did all of his men, and he lived to go on further expeditions.
And also explains why he got there about a month before Scott did.
Yes.
Because he was prepared. He had the tools and the wherewithal to be able to get to the South Pole.
And in 1911, the only way of getting over distances like that, in terrain like that, was through dogs. There was no other way. But ponies were ridiculous on their face. Scott also had motorized vehicles, which is an interesting thing and goes to the point that he was technically sophisticated. He was a far thinker in that way. But this is at the near birth of the internal combustion engine. The engines just weren't up to it. They overheated, which in Antarctica is not that easy to do.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The blocks cracked. They never did more than about 50 miles.
Wow. And you have a picture of one here of people, I guess, tinkering, trying to get this, a motor sledge up and running. We are talking about the race to the South Pole, it happened about a century ago. And again, our guest today on Radio Times is Ross McPhee. He's a curator in the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. In fact, has been to the Antarctic a number of times. And he's the author of a book called Race to the End of the Earth, Amundsen Scott and the Attainment of the South Pole. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. How did Amundsen know he was at the South Pole? How would you know that in Antarctica?
Well, there isn't a barber pole there.
I figured. Certainly not in 1911.
Right. It was difficult because they only had instruments like sextants that were largely used at sea for determining position. And he was terribly concerned that he wasn't spot on. So he spent 2 days at the pole taking measurement after measurement, sending his men on skis in all directions in the understanding that at least one of them would have crossed the actual place. The trouble with going to an abstraction like a pole is that there's nothing to tell you that you're there. It's not a mountain or a stream or something of that nature. It's just a place where the meridians converge, and that it has little significance other than that. It is the spin axis of the Earth, of course, but beyond that, geographically speaking, at a human level, it doesn't have much importance. So it took him a while to be very certain. He didn't want, for example, this is important to say, he didn't want the same problem that Fred Cook and Peary had when they both claimed to have made the North Pole, and they had terrible measurements that nobody believed, and they argued hideously among among themselves as to who was right. He wanted to nail it, and he did the best he could.
Well, let me get some callers in the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Robert from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And I look forward to reading your book, Russ. It's,
thank you, Robert.
It's a topic I've been very interested in since childhood. My grandfather, who was of Norwegian descent, met Amundsen on one of his lecture tours.
Oh, wow.
Back in the 1920s. I have been studying Amundsen and Manson and some of the others. Sverdrup noted that many of these men, particularly in prior to 1905, were conducting these explorations also with somewhat of a political reason. Norway, although they had a parliament, they were still under the crown rule, as I understand it, of Sweden.
Correct.
And they very much wanted to split. Perhaps you discuss this in your book. They wanted to peacefully split from Sweden and to be an independent country. And part of Nansen's earlier explorations were to do that and to gain notoriety, and I assume Amundsen somewhat followed in his footsteps.
Well, Robert, yeah, let me take your call and give Ross McPhee a chance to respond.
It was certainly true that Norway and Sweden wanted to split. At least the Norwegians did. They didn't feel they were being well served by the Swedes. It was a peaceful separation. It was actually just a parliamentary separation in the end. And what Norway had to do, as Robert said, was establish itself politically. Doing exploration was certainly one of the ways open to them as a major exploring nation. The Norwegians had been very important in Arctic exploration for a very long period. And ultimately, when Amundsen took the pole, he bearded the British lion, as they like to say, and that put Norway on the front burner for polar exploration thereafter.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did Amundsen, though, at the time get the credit he, I guess, deserved? Because as you write in this book, the fact that Scott and some of his team died almost made him sound like a martyr for this cause. What was the reaction once these two expeditions were done?
This is another thing that's hard for a contemporary audience to relate to very easily. Why would Amundsen be regarded as the loser, as
right,
it were,
exactly,
when he got there first? Well, one reason was that he was held in derision in Britain, particularly by the yellow press, because although he had money, government funding, to go and try and find the North Pole and to do research in the Arctic Ocean, he decided at the last minute, when that was grabbed by Peary and Cook, to go south instead. And why did he do that? For the same reason he did any of his explorations. He had to live in the public mind. He had to be first. He had to do something dramatic. And what he told his men was, well, we'll just do this slight deviation. We'll go all the way to the South Pole, get back in our jolly ship, and then head off for the Arctic. And, of course, they were astounded. They were Norwegians. They didn't want to go to the Antarctic, and Amundsen had to convince them. And apparently, at least for some of them, the telling line was to say, the Brits can't ski. So the idea was, yes, we can ski. We've been on ski since we were toddlers, and we'll beat them. So he didn't tell anybody, and he sailed directly from Norway all the way to his base on the Ross Ice Shelf without even touching on land, because he didn't want to be called back by the Norwegian government or anything of that nature. So he just essentially showed up on Scott's doorstep. Scott was only a few hundred miles away, and there he was with the intention to go south, and clearly he had only one goal in mind, which was to be first at the South Pole.
And the fact you had mentioned Scott's diary, his last entry is, "For God's sake, look after our people." Do you think there's something about those last lines from Scott that gave him the kind of acclaim that he didn't get because he didn't get to the South Pole first?
There's something very important to say about Scott, which is that he wrote like nobody else in the so-called heroic age of Antarctic exploration. He wrote beautifully. Hmm. He wrote in a way that draws you into his story, to all of his problems and issues and his irresoluteness and things of this nature. And at the end, as you say, Marty, this remark that look after those that we've left behind, because we did this, and this is important to say in the preceding paragraph, we did this for the honor of the British Empire. We did this for our country. We're not saying, oh, we're not going to come home and feel sorry for us. We took the risks, and it hasn't worked out for us. We will accept that, but look after our people. And that resonated, sure.
I'm looking at a picture, and I'm not going to do justice to our listeners, but it's a picture of six of the most bedraggled men I have ever seen, describing as after 9 months without a wash or a change of clothes. This was an expedition, it's almost just shocking to see what they look like. Who are these men, and what was that expedition about? What does that tell us about just how difficult these expeditions were at the time?
Tells you there's not a lot of showers in Antarctica.
I was going to say.
This is an image of Victor Campbell's people just before they walked back to McMurdo. This was a subsidiary expedition of the main expedition. They were dropped by ship on a different part of the Antarctic coast. They were only supposed to be there for a couple of weeks doing geological studies. And the ship, the Terra Nova, was not able to get back to them. So it had to leave, because the idea was that you don't want your ship frozen into the ice for the entire austral winter. It headed back to New Zealand, and these guys were on their own. Scott didn't know what had happened to them. He assumed that they'd been picked up. The Terra Nova hoped against hope that they would survive for the winter and figure things out, which they did.
How did they do that?
Well, it's a tribute to human ingenuity. They did have some supplies because they were only going to be there for a couple of weeks. They didn't do a complete unloading. They had very few clothes. They didn't have a big stock of food or anything, or fuel. What they did was eventually find a place on an island that they were able to hollow the snow out of and create what they called an igloo or a cave. And they survived there for 6 or 7 months on seal meat, on penguin meat, against the, you know, in conditions that would be hard to imagine people surviving today. They didn't die. Some of them, at least one of them, had a lot of severe emotional problems thereafter. But for the most part, they didn't talk about it, really.
How British is that,
yes,
right?
They walked back to McMurdo during the following summer. And this was great because it had just been found that Scott and his men had died, and everyone assumed that Victor Campbell's people came to a bad end as well, because the Terra Nova had come back by that time. And in the end, there they were tramping over the snow, getting back to Cape Evans. So it was a joyful reunion in the midst of a very, very serious situation.
Well, let's take another short break and continue our conversation and get some more callers in on our conversation as well. And again, Ross McPhee is our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about a book that he's written called Race to the End of the Earth, Amundsen, Scott, and the Attainment of the South Pole. Again, he's a curator in the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. He's been to the Antarctic 5 times, the last time about a year ago, and we do want to talk about his research. And we'll take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase has posted 5-year survival rates for major cancers on its website. Survival rates at Fox Chase are compared to those at community hospitals across the nation. This is but one measure of quality to help you make decisions about cancer care. At Fox Chase, compassionate care is much more than a number. It's part of their mission to prevail over cancer. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Marty Moscowen. We have an ambitious goal for the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. We need to hear from 8,000 listeners who want to be supporters, members of WHYY. You are one of those 8,000. You're listening to Radio Times, and we thank you for that. Now take that next step. pick up the phone and make a pledge of support right now. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Why do we want you to do that? Because we depend on listeners just like you for about half of our budget. Our job is to provide good conversations about the important issues of the day, and there is a lot to talk about these days. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We have the time on Radio Times to get beyond the headlines and to go deeper than the sound bites. Pick up that phone, 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks so much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Ross McPhee about the race just about a century ago to the South Pole, a race that pitted Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen against British naval officer Robert Falcon Scott. As you had mentioned, Scott was interested in science and interested in scientific research. Was he able to conduct any research of any significance as he was making this race to the South Pole?
Well, he was not himself a scientist, as we discussed earlier, but unlike Amundsen, he took along a number of scientists with him on his expeditions because he regarded that as being the primary reason for going to Antarctica. Yes, he wanted to get to the South Pole. There's no question, at least in my mind, that he wanted that token, that brass ring, to be his. At the same time, he made sure that his scientists were able to conduct their research. And what kinds of research? There was geology, geomorphology, marine biology, magnetics, ice physics, and so on. He had, in other words, a fair range of things going on. And it's important to realize, however, that most of the scientific work was conducted at the base camp at Cape Evans, and that's for obvious reasons. If you needed instrumentation, you're not going to haul that along with you by man-hauling, probably. And if you are geologizing, you want to go to the places where the rock samples are, which is not in the middle of the polar plateau, which is all snow for 10,000 feet. So the scientists, by and large, not all of them, but most of them, stayed around McMurdo doing their work. And like these early expeditions, they came home and were obliged to publish their results. Most of the stuff, of course, has been very seriously superseded. That's the way science works. But it's of great interest to note that the meteorological records, which were very carefully kept by a very competent professional meteorologist, have reemerged in recent years because scientists of our times need those kinds of data from the distant past, before they had all the kinds of modern instrumentation that they do now, in order to track things like climate change and to answer the question, well, are things warming?
Exactly. And?
So there's a continuing importance, in other words, for the work that scientifically that was accomplished in these early expeditions.
Let me get Richard from Wayne to join our conversation. Richard, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Oh, Marty, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My impression was that I think Amundsen liked and admired Dr. Fred Cook, who had been on an expedition down to the South Pole or to Antarctica previous to that. And I was wondering if your guest knew that or felt that Amundsen believed Cook had actually discovered the North Pole instead of Peary, which was, I think, the popular belief, or ended up becoming the popular belief. And I had gotten the impression that Amundsen did not believe or had some doubt as to Peary's accomplishment. And I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks, Richard, for calling in. Ross McPhee, go ahead.
This is a good point, Richard. There's no question that they were friends. On the Belgic expedition to the Antarctic, the one you were talking about, the chaos reigned most of the time, but in Fred Cook, Amundsen saw somebody who was, in his own sphere, very competent. Fred Cook was a doctor, and one of the issues they faced was scurvy. Fred Cook said, the one thing we can do is eat fresh meat. It wasn't known that vitamin C resided in muscle tissue and so on at this time, and that if you ate fairly fresh meat, you could at least get a little bit of vitamin C. And Amundsen listened to that, and made it through without scurvy, whereas other members of the expedition poo-pooed the idea and, at least in one case, died of scurvy. Hmm. So he had reason to have a very high opinion of Fred Cook. He never publicly said that he doubted that Fred Cook made it to the pole. In fact, it was really the opposite. He said that he thought he was an upstanding, honest explorer, and that if he said that he made it to the pole, then he made it. There was a similar controversy, as the listener probably knows, about being the first up Mount Denali in Alaska. Fred Cook claimed to have reached the top. It's now very clear from all kinds of evidence that he did not, even though he claimed it. And for some people, this was much of a muchness. This was his pattern, that he would assert that he had done this and that and actually hadn't done it.
Thanks for calling in, Richard. I do want to talk about some of your work in Antarctica, but one of the things that you write about these two men, you say Scott was in love with words, Amundsen with deeds. Does that that tells us a lot about these two men.
I think it does. One of the things that you actually don't see very often is an explorer who can write really well. There's not a lot of them. Mostly it's very matter of fact. I did this on this day, I did that on the next day. They tend not to be terribly retrospective, or rather introspective, in what they're talking about in their journals. But Scott was different, and he was very different at the time, because at the time it was considered poor form to be whinging away in your journal about how the food was bad or you didn't get along with the commander and all of this kind of thing. So people didn't. And Scott was refreshingly different in the narrow sense that he said in his journal what he was feeling. Now, a lot of things that he said were way out of line, I think, with the actual reality of what was going on. He took a very severe line. Maybe this was his Royal Navy training, to anybody who was out of line. And the thing that's important to remember is that the Terra Nova expedition was civilian. It was not Royal Navy, although many of the people on the expedition were in the Navy or associated with the Navy. It was civilian. And Scott had people who were just straight up civilians. And you can imagine who is the worst to deal with. The scientists. It's like herding cats. And for that reason, Scott had some very scathing things to say about some members of the expedition. But he also was self-aware enough, I think, to understand that where he went wrong was not planning in a way that covered contingencies. He was very surprised, for example, at how bad the winter of 1912 was. Now, he'd been to Antarctica before. He knew what winter was like there. He'd been there several years. And it's, again, shocking to me that, having been to Antarctica, in my case, several times, you don't go for the average, because it's the variance that's going to kill you. And you just have an understanding that things are probably going to get very bad at some point. And if they do, you're going to be in trouble. And he seriously was deficient in making his mind up about who to take, what to take, how to take it, in a way that Amundsen never was. And I think that's fundamentally one of the major reasons why he went wrong.
And that's Ross McPhee, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a curator in the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also written a book called Race to the End of the Earth, about the race between Roald Amundsen and Robert Falcon Scott to get to the South Pole. Our guest has been to Antarctica 5 times. The last time was about a year ago. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And I'm Dave Davies, alongside Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder, and we're interrupting for just a few moments to invite you to join us in supporting Radio Times and all the other great programs that you hear here on WHYY. It's our winter membership campaign, one that's pretty doggone important in getting the year off right. We really count on a lot of folks to step up and renew their memberships, to join if you're new. And you probably know how to do it, but let me remind you. You go to the phone, pick a number, what you think this service is worth to you on an annual basis, and call us at 1-888-345-9499, or go to our secure website at whyy.org. You know, Debbie Bilder, before we went on the air, you and I were just listening to this conversation, the typical Radio Times experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's riveting listening. I love these, which is probably why I booked this, but imagining 100 years ago in this, you know, frozen, frigid desert, what these two men, very different men, how they approach trying to reach the South Pole, and these stories that kind of take you there and take you back, and that Marty has an hour to do it. So give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-9499. You're listening to this. You're probably just as fascinated as we are. Pick up the phone now and give us a call. Renew your membership or become a new member.
You know, we really count on folks who enjoy Radio Times to step up and make that clear. It's on at times of the day when some folks can't get to the radio. If you're somebody who does frequently and really enjoys it, you can let Marty and her staff and Debbie know how much you value what they do day in and day out. And, of course, there are great ways to say thank you, and our volunteers can run all that by you. One thing I like are the 16-ounce pint glasses with a neat WHYY logo. I own a set myself, and I enjoy seeing them on my table. That's yours for a pledge of $100. The WHYY umbrella is always a great favorite, $120. And for any pledge of $50 or more, if you make it on a credit card, we will throw in Newsweek every week for a year for free. So there are plenty of ways to say thanks, but the important thing is that you're joining us in just putting another brick in the wall. We managed to do an amazing thing here, we believe, by relying on you one pledge at a time, one check at a time, one credit card charge at a time. And here in day three of our winter membership campaign, we'll hope you'll step right up and do it. As Debbie said, the number, 1-888-345-9499, or online at whyy.org.
And I think today is a good example of the kind of variety that Marty does every day. We started out with a discussion, a debate about same-sex marriage, whether it should be left to a referendum or through the legislative process. And now we're talking about polar explorers. So if you appreciate that variety that we hit on everything, whether it's politics, history, economics, medicine, new breakthroughs in health, give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-9499. You can also go online to whyy.org and pledge there.
Yeah, I agree, Debbie. This is a typically kind of interesting Radio Times day. The first hour, I mean, we talked about this in the last break, was two people who really disagree passionately with one another. Mm-hmm. But because they're on a show that has the time and they have a host like Marty, they get a chance to say what they think. And I know that when you and the other producers find guests for a particularly controversial issue, one of the things you look for is someone who will listen, someone who is respectful of other points of view. There's no reason you can't be passionate and still be respectful. And I think you hear that day in, day out. And then an hour or two, gosh, what a great little tale told by a guy who himself has traveled to the Antarctic.
Right, a real expert.
Yeah, has a real feel for it. I mean, that really is just such great examples of what's done here. And, you know, if you go back to the Radio Times area, you will see dozens and dozens, scores, hundreds of books that come through. A lot of authors want to get on Radio Times, and it's a big job for the producers to sift through them and mm-hmm. find the ones who not only have great stories to tell, but who can tell them. It isn't easy. It takes a lot of time and effort and patience, but we think the results are really special. If you agree, take a step to support it. The number is 1-888-345-9499 or on the website at whyy.org.
Yeah, you know, one of the jobs of a producer is to sort of stay up on everything, which means, you know, watching a lot of different television shows, listening to a lot of different radio shows, you know, going over a lot of blogs, reading a lot of newspapers. And whenever I come back to WHYY and everything, all the programs from the reporting to Fresh Air to Radio Times to the NPR coverage, I'm just constantly impressed with the quality. I mean, we talked about it a minute ago, the quality of the guests. They're experts. They really do know what they're talking about, the civil dialogue that goes on, the respect, the analysis that's really important and that you value as a listener. Help us make sure that this kind of radio continues, these kinds of ideas and analysis continue. 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-9499, and give us your support.
You know, after the last break, Debbie, it's funny. I went up to my desk and there I got a phone call from a listener who admonished me for being a little too enthusiastic about Marty and the show and for other programs.
You got to be enthusiastic.
I have to say, guilty as charged. And what I would say to anybody who thinks maybe I'm overselling it is look around and compare it to what else is out there. As Debbie just said, you can find a Shoutfest on cable TV. There's a lot of ways to get a lot of different points of view. But if you compare it to the kind of the quality that you hear here day in, day out on this program and others, I think it's worth your contribution and your support. And you know, Debbie, I have a special affection, I have to say, for people who pledge in the middle of a fund drive. A lot of folks jump in on day one, and then the procrastinators all pile in on the last day. But here in the middle, it can get a little quiet. We can hit an air pocket, and it's not like people aren't listening. It's not like people don't care. It's just there's no particular reason that they have to do it right now. Well, I'm asking you, do it right now. It will really, it'll pick us up and it'll keep us on a pace so that we're not so anxious that we're not going to get what we need to get
there
done.
There you go.
In this fall, this winter membership campaign. That listener called at 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. So you can make the phone ring or you can make the pledges ping by going to the website at WHYY.org. We'll be going back to NPR and then shortly. But there is time for you to make that pledge, and we hope you will.
Marty's been doing this for 25 years. Actually, this is our 25th anniversary. I haven't been with her that whole time, but she has been, you know, day in, day out, weekdays, been doing these programs. And one of the great things about Radio Times is if you miss a show, you can go online and podcast it. I mean, I always am podcasting shows that I miss, whether I'm walking my dog or in the summer gardening, listening to shows that I miss to try to catch up on. And that's another incredible service that you can do. I mean, if you're interested in this hour on Polar Explorers, we did a show last year about adventuring in the modern age and how GPS and satellite phones have changed the sort of notion of really out there. So you can go back and browse through our archives and podcast programs to listen to. Give us your support. Become a member or a new member. 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY.
Yeah, and there's some of the terrific topics that you and the producers come up with about cultural trends or emotions. I mean, there was one thing about guys hugging years ago that you're like, what? And it was a terrific show because it was about this phenomenon that we're seeing more. You had people who had a sense of kind of the history of kind of body language and physical affection among men. It was a really interesting hour. And there aren't many people who come up with ideas like that, but the Radio Times staff does. You know, I also want to kind of remind folks that your support needs to be concrete. There are plenty of people I meet all the time who, when they hear I work at WHYY, you know, tell us how much they love the station.